We're looking at prophetic bridges, building around the fact that Jesus was truly the Messiah, prophesied in the Old Testament, fulfilled in the New. And the first few minutes, I'd like to give us some little overall perspective that will boil down, as much as I know how to boil it down, the perspective we need to have on prophecy, especially prophecy that anticipates the Messiah. And there are a couple of things that ought to be in our memory. And the object of this little section right here is to try to boil down as much as possible that which we've been doing in some detail. So the overall perspective on prophecy is this. First, its basic characteristic. What is the basic characteristic? If we have to boil the whole thing down to a basic fundamental point, there are two. They're both very similar, but there are two. Number one, and we touched this last time, but it is so fundamental, that the prophets spoke, and both of our two sentences will begin in the same way. The prophets spoke of themselves. And what that means is when David writes a psalm, he is talking about himself in a given situation, a situation in which he is suffering, a situation in which he is offering a complaint, a situation in which he is offering a petition. And throughout his writing and throughout the Psalms, David will speak of himself as all the prophets do. The prophets spoke of themselves and beyond themselves. So that prophecies in the Old Testament ought to be thought of in terms of unfolding. So that if you had something folded up, the prophet is talking about himself, and that unfolds beyond himself. And that is typical of Old Testament prophecies and Old Testament prophets. And again, I'm going to repeat this at the risk of your saying you're being repetitious. That's fine. I'm doing that on purpose because this is so very fundamental in looking at Old Testament prophets. They spoke about themselves, true, but they also spoke beyond themselves. And in order to nail down that point, let me give two key verses. And whenever we give a key verse, it simply means that this is a representative verse. This is a concept that is seen over and over, but for sake of memory, let's put down a key verse. And the key verse in the Old Testament would be Psalm 16:10. And I'm giving this as a key verse, as a representative example, because it demonstrates the point that we just made. So that as the psalm begins, David is clearly speaking of himself and about himself. So when he says, verse 1, "Preserve me, O God, for I take refuge in thee," he's talking about himself. "I said to the Lord, Thou art my Lord, I have no good besides thee," and so forth. However, when we come to verse 10, you find a verse that simply will not fit David. It says, "Thou wilt not abandon my soul to Sheol," simply a word for grave, "to the grave, neither wilt thou allow thy Holy One to undergo decay." And the problem that is involved is coming through the psalm, so far, thy Holy One appears to be a reference to David. However, it says something about David that simply was not true, or was not applicable to David, because David did go to the grave, David did die, and David did undergo in the grave all the processes that would be involved in the deterioration and the decay of the body. So you've got a verse that simply does not fit David by himself. The New Testament writers grab that concept, such as in Acts, and this is our second key verse for this. Acts 3:22-28, and we're looking at the Apostle Peter. And Peter is looking at Psalm 16:10, And Peter observes just exactly what we just observed, namely that verse spoken by David went beyond David and thus is at the heart of prophecy. Chapter 3, 22. Yeah, one chapter off, not bad at all. 2:22, sorry. As he speaks to the nation of Israel, he has in his mind Psalm 16, he has in his mind verse 10, and he has in his mind that that could not apply to David, but he does proclaim whom it does apply to, so men of Israel. Listen to these words, Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. Notice, by the way, Peter's perspective on miracles is not that they were merely acts of mercy, not that they were simply the heart of Jesus responding to the physical needs of men, but the signs were indicated, the miracles were signs. They were intended to, as the verb puts in verse 22, to attest. So he introduces the evidence of miracles which they had seen. He interprets that as an attestation by God with these signs and miracles. And so continuing, this man, verse 23, delivered up by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power. And they were looking, and he's reviewing the historical things that they had seen in terms of miracles, in terms of the death of Jesus, which they had witnessed and they knew about, and in terms of the resurrection. Now, he takes that and bridges back to the Old Testament. 4, verse 25, David says of him. And to take our sentence once again, the prophets spoke of themselves and beyond themselves, and we can take the of and the beyond, or the of and the beyond, and say David spoke of David and of one beyond himself, namely Jesus. And this is his argument. And he goes in verse 25 by quoting from Psalm 16, beginning in verse 7, and down to verse 27, thou wilt not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow thy Holy One to undergo decay. And then you come to verse 29, and he makes his observation. Brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us today. And he is simply appealing to what they know to be the case, and then creating the problem, which is verse 30. So, here's his conclusion. Because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with the oath to seat one of his descendants upon the throne, and he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Messiah, that he was neither abandoned to Hades nor did his flesh suffer decay, this Jesus, which again is linked to the Messiah, God raised up again, to which we're all witnesses. So the idea is David spoke of himself. He also spoke beyond himself. The one of whom he spoke beyond himself was the Christ or the Messiah. And the next leap is this Messiah is, so Peter's link is to Jesus. So you have that characteristic. Second, the prophets not only spoke of, but beyond themselves, they spoke of, now we need to broaden this out, their generation. Sometimes messianic prophecy is not just wrapped up in one, but in the whole generation, spoke of their generation and beyond their generation. Two principles are essentially the same, except one is a little bigger than the other. And for that, key verses, Hosea, prophet Hosea, 10:1. Hosea 11:1. And in Hosea 11:1, Hosea makes the following statement, and the identity of the one of whom he is speaking is very clear. When Israel was a youth, I loved him. So the prophet is speaking of the history of the nation of Israel. And out of Egypt, I have called my son. So two parallel lines in the Hebrew poetic style. Israel was a youth, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. So that the word I love matches I called in the second line. And the word Israel matches the word my son in verse 2. So he's referencing historically back to the Exodus of calling Israel out of Egypt, or the of calling him his son out of Egypt. And therefore he's speaking of his generation or of his people, but also beyond his people. And Hosea 11:1 shows us that. Now look at the way Matthew uses the same passage from Matthew 2 and verse 15. Well, let's go to 13 to get the entire context. 2:13. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, Arise and take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, and for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him. And he arose and took the child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, and here is Matthew's link, that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, quote, and he's going to Hosea chapter 11, out of Egypt did I call my son. And notice here, my son is interpreted to be Jesus. And therefore, you have the same idea, is that what Hosea the prophet spoke unfolded, characteristic of messianic prophecy. So we should tie the key verses expressing that as Hosea 11:1 and Matthew 2:13-15. Second, and we're trying to put things in a capsule now. There were many messiahs in the Old Testament. There was also one specific spoken of in the Old Testament. And therefore you have in the Old Testament anointed ones. Anointed, remember the word for the meaning of the word Messiah. Anointed ones of the Old Testament were used by God to prophesy of the anointed one. Principle. Anointed ones, plural, of the Old Testament were used by God to prophesy of the anointed one. One versus ones. For example, all of your prophets, all of your kings, I don't know of any unanointed king over Israel. All of the kings were anointed as special, and thus David as king. Central to the office of kingship was an anointing as king, and he was an anointed one. But the principle is, these anointed ones all focus and recognize that in the Old Testament there was the anointed one that occupied a very, very special place, and therefore anointed ones anticipate the anointed one. Second. That means then, and here's the easy way to remember it, it's the popular expression of it, Old Testament prophets were, and these two words are easy to remember because they sound alike, were foretellers and foretellers. Foretellers in the sense that they addressed the present. Foretellers in that they address the future. And those two words being alike are easy to remember. They may oversimplify a little bit, but they do express the idea involved in Old Testament prophecy. Or we could put it in another way. In the Old Testament, the present was the seed bed of the future. Now, having said that and taken 20 minutes to do it, we need to complete today some of the details that are involved in making the bridge between the Old Testament Messiah prophesied and Jesus. And the first one we have already covered. The Messiah will be betrayed by a close friend. We have covered that. Okay. Betrayed by a close friend. Two. There are three minute details of the betrayal foretold by Zechariah. And let's go to that. Or find the book of Zechariah. Easy to find. We're in Matthew, two to your left. Next to the last book of the Old Testament. Now we might add, and whenever you say or speak about a Jewish interpretation of the Messianic passages, you always have to remember something about, if you've read anything of Jewish interpretation, the way the rabbis approach things, always remember the old joke among the rabbis. If there are two rabbis, there will always be four opinions. And the idea was that part of rabbinic training was to look at every option. That didn't mean you bought every option, but part of the basic concept, and it's a good one, was you ought to look at every way these words can be approached. And the rabbis did that, and consequently, it's hard to put a finger, Jewish interpretation, which one or whose is the idea. But nonetheless, in the prophet Zechariah, and we're looking at let's go to chapter 1. Zechariah dates himself. And he does so by reference to Darius Hystaspes, verse 1, in the eighth month of the second year of Darius. And there were many Darius, so if you want to be precise and or look in historical references, Hystaspes, that's the one he's speaking of. The word of the Lord came to Zechariah the prophet, the son of Zechariah, the son of Iddo, saying, and he continues his prophecy. But nonetheless, this gives us a possibility of a date. And the prophet dates himself by this man, Darius, and we happen to know the dates of this particular man, which were 521 to 485 B.C. Zechariah has another prophecy, and he dates it also by him in verse 7, on the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month Shabbat, in the second year of Darius. And then you come over to chapter 7, and we have to add a little more because we go farther into the reign of Darius. And in 7:1, then it came about in the fourth year of King Darius that the word of the Lord came to Zechariah, and that is the last time that he dates himself. So we are looking then with the prophecy of chapter 13 that we're going to be looking at, somewhere around 518, 519 for the prophecy. So you've got Zechariah the prophet tied into the secular history of the time by the reign of King Darius. So then, we're well before the birth of Jesus, which was probably 4, 5, 6, 7 B.C. So we're, let's say, roughly speaking, we're looking 500 years, half a millennium. And in chapter 13, where we need to focus, the prophet Zechariah, speaking of himself, but beyond himself, gives us three details concerning the one that is sent to Israel and is rejected. Number one, he speaks about the amount of the betrayal money. Second, and this is Zechariah 11:13. Second, he will say something about not only the amount, but about the deposit of the money relative to the temple. And that also is in Zechariah 11:13. And then third, he will say something about the final use of the money in Zechariah 11:13. So looking at that verse, the entire context is of one who would shepherd Israel. And you come down to verse 12, where the shepherd of Israel becomes so disgusted with the behavior of the people that he addresses them. And he says, all right, evaluate me. Tell me what I'm worth. And that is the context. So verse 12, I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages, what you think I'm worth. But if not, forget it. Never mind. So they weighed out 30 pieces of silver as my wages. And so the evaluation of Zechariah the prophet is he's worth 30 pieces of silver. And again, it is important to press, I think, the prophet for precise fulfillment. First of all, the price was not arbitrary. It was not a matter of what we have. If we tie it to the Torah in Exodus 21 and verse 32, the amount was not arbitrary, but significant. So look, keeping Zechariah open, at Exodus 21, 32. The Torah often would assign certain reparations and certain wages that were set for various things. Various damages would require so much payment and so forth. And in regard to chapter 21, you have one of those reparations set forth, which is in verse 32. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And so the price then is that of a gored slave. It's a low price because what good is a gored slave? Couldn't serve, couldn't function, couldn't do what he was supposed to do, and therefore that price of the silver was placed on the gored slave. So that when we come to Zechariah, the response to his ministry is, you are not worth a gored slave. So it's the evaluation is an insult as far as the price that they we could put it another way, this was half the price of a free man. One half the price of a free man. So it is not arbitrary, and we should put not 29, not 31, and not silver, not gold, or anything else. Is the prophet precise? And that will be very, very important. So the second thing then that is made is something about the deposit of the money. And that also is in verse 13. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price that I was valued by them. So I took the silver, the 30 shekels of silver, and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. The house of the Lord is consistently a reference to the temple. So the placing of the money is to be thrown. So with the deposit, again, the idea is, here's the important thing. You could deposit money in the temple. And there was a word for a legitimate gift. In fact, you were required to deposit money in the temple. This is not the word for that. This is not the normal word for temple giving. The word that is used in this verse, which is translated in our version, thrown both times, throw it and he threw it, is exactly analogous, and we can make the analogy. We this morning will take an offering, but it's done in an orderly way. A plate is passed, and you will place something in the plate if you so choose. And there's a word for that, what we're doing. However, the word used here, you couldn't put it in the box. You would come to the front door, or the treasury door as it would be then, and you would throw it, literally. Take your money and throw it. And that is the word that is used here. And therefore the emphasis upon the deposit of money is on the way it gets deposited. It's going to be thrown, not placed, not given, not done in an orderly way, but one for flinging. Fling is a good translation. If you trace the Hebrew verb throughout the Old Testament, it was inevitably used of something for which you had disdain. It was throwing away garbage. It was throwing away what you did not want. So we should expect then the 30 pieces of the right amount, and we should expect it to be deposited in a certain way, thrown, not given. Then finally, you have something about the use of it. It will be used for the potter. Okay, now let's go to the New Testament parallel. And that is found in Matthew 26, and go back to verse 15, or 14 of chapter 26, says, "Then one of the 12, named Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, 'What are you willing to give me to deliver him to you?' And they weighed out to him 30 pieces of silver." Notice not 29, 31, and not gold, silver. Then you come over to chapter 27 and verse 3. "Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, 'I have sinned by betraying innocent blood.'" And then you come down to the matter of deposit and look at Matthew 27, verse 5. It says, as he has a little dialogue with the chief priest, verse 4, he says, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." But they said, "What's that to us? See to that yourself." And it apparently angers Judas, so he threw. Notice the manner of deposit. He threw the piece of silver into the sanctuary, departed, went away, and hanged himself. As to the final use of it or disposition of it, Matthew 27, verse 7. 6, verse 6. "The chief priest took the pieces of silver which he had flung into the temple and said, 'It is not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood.'" So the question is, it can't remain where Judas threw it. "And they counseled together," verse 7, with the money, bought the potter's field as a place, as a burial place for strangers." So you have three interesting details that come together in this particular section. We're close at this point, and might want to mark staying in Zechariah. Just put your pencil there or something, because we're going to start with Zechariah 13:7. And what that will prophesy is that in the context of all of this, something else will be taking place, and that will be the disciples of the Lord are going to forsake him. We'll pick up with that next time. Father, we're thankful for your word, its truthfulness. We're thankful for the words of the Hebrew prophets, of their accuracy, of their use in your hand as vehicles of the communication of truth. We thank you for that great, great book of the Hebrew canon of the Old Testament. In your name, amen.